Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for coming back to continue our journey with Jesus. We've been exploring how Jesus overcame powerful emotions, including disappointment, melancholy, how he became a transformer of those emotions into liberating action. And the example that that might provide for us at our moment in time. So we continue the journey with Jesus today, and today we come to Jerusalem, the city toward which, you remember, he had set his face. He knows what waits for him there. And the actions that he takes in our text for today are very instructive, I would argue. Very helpful for us today. Luke chapter 19, verse 28. And after having said these things, he was going ahead. You see that resolution, that determination? The Greek word is improsthen, in front of. He was going out ahead of the disciples, going up to Jerusalem. And it happened as he came near to Bethphage and Bethany, toward the mountain called the Mount of
Olives.
He sent two of his disciples. Now, archaeologists have been unable to identify the village of Bethphage. So it's time for all of us here at Epiphany to organize an archaeological dig, which I would love to do with you. Bethphage, the name means house of wild figs. And if I had to, I could live on figs, I think. So let's go look for it. So Bethany, of course, we know where that village was. It's about 2 miles east of Jerusalem. It is up on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. You may remember that the Gospel of John locates in Bethany Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Lazarus, whom Jesus loved, and for whom he what? Wept when Lazarus died. We'll come back to that. And he sent his disciples and said to them, "Go into the village that lies before us. When you enter it, you will find a young ass." The Greek word is holos. Can you say that with me?
Holos.
And it literally means a foal or a colt of an ass. So Jesus says, when you go into the village that lies before us, you will find a young ass, a polos, on which no one has ever sat. Untie it and bring it here. And if anyone asks you, why do you untie it? You shall say, yes, its Lord or its Master has need of it. You're exactly right. And when those who had been sent were going, they found the ass just as he had told them. And while they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, "Why are you untying our colt?" And they answered, "Because the master has need of it." Now, what's going on here? Jesus' command to the disciples is surprising. We're so familiar with it from the constant reading of this text in Palm Sunday that we may not immediately recognize how difficult and preposterous this is, what Jesus asked the disciples to do. First of all, up to this point, in the journey down from Jerusalem, from Galilee to Jerusalem, Jesus has been what? On foot. Walking. Which is what a Passover pilgrim is expected to do. In the Jewish law, required to do. To make the pilgrimage from Galilee on foot. So, why does he now propose to ride? To mount a colt. Well, clearly, Jesus has something in mind. But what is it? And the instructions appear on the face of them to be impossible to carry out. In the ancient world, only military and political authorities had the right to requisition. To impound supplies, animals, to impound provisions. The Greek word for this rite is angareia. Can you say that with me? Angareia. It's the right to requisition or to impound. Now, Jesus is not a military or a political leader. He is what? A poor Galilean. He's a carpenter turned rabbi. So what gives him the right to requisition, to impound an animal? And why should the owners of the young ass permit the disciples to take it? You see the situation here? And now the disciples are told to justify their requisition or impoundment by saying what? The master has need of it. So the Greek word is kreia, the need, is used in order to justify it. But why should Jesus think that that would be sufficient? When I was trying to sort through all of this, a memory came suddenly back into my head. When Diane and I were students long ago in New Haven, Connecticut, we had booked a flight home to Arkansas, and with one thing and another, we looked at the clock and realized we couldn't get to the airport on time. And so, I don't know what possessed me. I ran downstairs out onto the street in front of our apartment and requisitioned a vehicle. This was before Uber and Lyft, right? And I just ran up to the first car I saw and said, "We've got to get to the airport. You're going to take us." And Diane can tell you, it's true. He took us. I don't know where I had the hoot spot. You know, when you're young, you feel invincible. Well, Jesus's purpose becomes clear when we remind ourselves of a prophecy that he is dramatizing. The prophecy is found in the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. And here is what it says. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter Jerusalem. Lo, your king comes to you. Triumphant and victorious is he," listen, "humble and what? Mounted upon a young ass, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." He's dramatizing, he's stage managing his entry into the city. And listen to the next verse. It's always important to look at the whole context of a scripture when a text is being evoked or cited. Listen to the next verse in Zechariah. He will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall command, do you know, peace to the nations. Wow. So Jesus engages. Jesus, who knows what awaits him in Jerusalem, who knows that the kingdom of God will not fall from the sky without suffering, who has been battling throughout the journey with powerful emotions, he finds somehow the strength to engage in a prophetic action, a symbolic gesture. He dramatizes Zechariah's prophecy, and in doing that, he steps into the role of God's agent. If someone has to do it, he says, let it be me. Boy, there's a lesson for us there, right? If, like me, you're struggling a little bit these days with the loss of an ideal, with the disappointment of a hope, here's the way forward. Maybe we could individually or as a group give some thought to symbolic actions. Symbolic actions that would arouse the conscience of our contemporaries, that would point the way forward toward a better future. Chapter 19, verses 35 to 38. Then they led the colt to Jesus, and when they had thrown their garments on the young ass, they helped Jesus to mount it. Now, on the one hand, they are providing him with a kind of saddle for the mount, but the placing of garments on the back of a mount was something that was done in the ancient world for whom? Kings, royalty. So you see this, the disciples are now what? They comprehend his gesture, and they are doing what? Contributing to the drama. They're playing along. They're joining hands with him in what he is about to do. Evidently, they comprehend his purpose now in requisitioning the ass, and they are contributing to the prophetic drama. Next verse. And while he rode ahead, they, we don't know who the they is it the disciples or the crowds? Luke doesn't tell us. They spread their garments on the way. Now, if it is the crowds who are spreading the garments, as Matthew says in his gospel and Mark in his gospel, then evidently it wasn't only the disciples that what? Got the point, that comprehended the prophetic symbolic gesture. The crowds understood it too. In the ancient world, when a political leader, a general or a governor visited a city, the citizens would respond by welcoming the person. They would come out of their houses. They would decorate the streets of their city. They would spread garments on the road in front of him. And they organized speeches of welcome for the dignitary. So I think that's what the crowds are doing. They get it. But unlike a general or a king or a governor, unlike Pontius Pilate, for example, who came into Jerusalem, according to Josephus, mounted on a beautiful white war horse, Jesus is riding on what? A donkey. The foal of an ass. A symbol of what? Humility. A symbol of peace. So the gesture, the symbolic gesture that Jesus has devised here calls into question our assumptions about power. Who claims our hearts? Who deserves our loyalty? Is it Pontius Pilate on the white horse? Or is it this rabbi mounted on the colt of an ass? And look how the crowd responds. When they drew near to the foot of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude began to praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works or deeds that they had seen. And they said, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace." See, they've gotten the message. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Now, what is it that they have seen, actually? The conquest of a city? No. They've seen what? Simple acts of goodness. The healing of sick people. The liberation of demon-possessed people. They've seen people whose hearts have been lifted up and inspired by words about God and God's kingdom. And what the text is telling us is that it's these ordinary acts of goodness that are the way to cosmic peace. Peace where? In the heaven, and glory throughout everything. But watch the reaction. Chapter 19, verse 39. But some of the Pharisees. Now, we met them last week, didn't we? This is the group of people who tried to intensify and reclaim the purity of Jewish identity by obedience to the law. They wanted to put a hedge around their community. Pure people eating pure food together. Some of the Pharisees from the crowd. So Luke portrays the Pharisees being in the crowd of people, witnessing Jesus' symbolic action. Some of the Pharisees called out to him, "Master, rebuke your disciples. Silence these people who are praising God for the acts of kindness to the nothings and the nobodies." That's not the agenda of the Pharisees. And Jesus answered them, "I tell you, if these people are silent, what? The stones will what? Cry out." Now, that's another allusion to a prophecy. It's the prophet Habakkuk. Don't you love his name? I'm glad my mother didn't name me Habakkuk. But it has a wonderful resonance to it. So it's an allusion that Jesus makes here to Habakkuk. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 11 speaks of the stones of a stone house crying out against a thief who has entered, a robber, a plunderer, an oppressor. The stones of the house protest against criminal intentions. The stones cry out the truth. Now, this remark of Jesus here looks ahead to what's coming in the future for Jerusalem, for his own people. The stones are going to cry out. And we could apply that to our situation today, couldn't we? The attempt to silence to cover up. You remember how Nixon attempted to cover up the Watergate burglary? But it did what? It came out anyway. The stones will cry out the truth. Chapter 19, verse 41. When he drew near to the city, he wept over her. Now, this is only one. This is one of two places in the New Testament where Jesus is said to have wept. The other one is where? Yeah, the Gospel of John, where Jesus is informed that his good friend Lazarus has died. And so the author of the fourth Gospel says that Jesus doc ruo. Can you say that with me?
Doc ruo.
Doc ruo means to shed tears. So when he hears about the death of Lazarus, his eyes fill up with tears. Tears run down his cheeks. That is not the verb that is used here. When Jesus sees, when he comes within sight of the city of Jerusalem, the verb that is used here is a much stronger verb. It's the verb klio. Can you say that with me? Klio. This verb means not merely to shed tears, it means to wail and to weep, to sob. Let me give examples. In the Gospel of Matthew, when Herod puts to death the infants of Bethlehem under the age of 2 years, the mothers of those infants do this. Klio. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus comes across a funeral procession, a widow from the village of Nain is following the bier of her only son who has died. And this is what she does. Klio. So it's a very profound emotion that Luke is describing here. Jesus wept. He sobbed. He wailed. It's what mothers do over slaughtered infants. And Jesus said, the next verse, if this day even you had been able to recognize the things that lead to peace, dot, dot, dot. In other words, the statement, the sentence remains what? Incomplete, unfinished. Now, this is a figure of speech. In ancient Greek, also in Hebrew, in Greek, the figure of speech is called apoceopasis. And you see the word for silence here, right? Siopo? Apoceopasis. You deliberately can't finish a statement. You're unable to because you're filled with what? Helpless regret. That's what's being described here. It's helpless regret. The figure of apoceopasis shows how charged Jesus is with emotion. Oh, if only the city had been able to recognize. And Jesus continues, but now it is hidden from your eyes. Yes?
Question you, the order in there, is he riding on the colt when he left where Mary and Martha and Lazarus lived? But before he got into Jerusalem, they would know about him because of the testimony there.
They would.
And the other thought was, the stones crying out may foretell he's getting into the tomb, and the stones crying out and releasing him.
Both of those are very interesting thoughts. And not bad at all as conjectures. Unfortunately, Luke doesn't tell us the name of the village where the disciples found what? The colt tied up. But hold on to those thoughts. Those are very interesting thoughts. But now Jesus says, it is hidden from your eyes. Now this is a hard reality that we have to face. It's the reality of our moment too. It is the human right, God-given right, to close our eyes to the truth. It belongs to human freedom, doesn't it? God created us as free moral agents, and we have the right to close our eyes to the truth. And as a result of our doing that, guess what happens? The truth grows dim. You can't see it clearly anymore. But now you have hidden, but now it is hidden from your eyes. Next verse. Because, Jesus says, the days will come upon you when your enemies will raise up a rampart, and they will surround you, and they will dash you and your children to the ground, and they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Now, Jesus' brief description here of the siege of Jerusalem that came in 69 AD is very graphic and accurate. And the vocabulary is technical. That word that's translated rampart is the Greek word charax. Can you say that with me?
Charax.
Whenever the Romans laid siege to a city, they did two things. First, they built a ramp of earth leading up to the city, which was set upon a high place like Jerusalem. They built a ramp leading up to it. And then guess what they did? Does anyone know? Military historians, readers of Julius Caesar? They circumvallated the city. Circumvallation. In other words, they dug a deep trench around the city so that people could not what? Get out. So that they couldn't escape. And that's exactly what Jesus says is going to happen. And then his description of what will happen to the inhabitants. The Greek word is edaphizo. Can you say that with me? Edaphizo. Try one more time. Edaphizo. It means to reduce to the level of the ground. To demolish. To fling against the earth violently. That's what's going to happen to the inhabitants. Now, Jesus' description of the siege of Jerusalem is concise. There is a painfully detailed description, of course, in the fourth book of the Jewish Wars by Josephus, who was born about the time that Jesus died. Josephus saw the whole thing up close. He was taken captive by the Romans, held as a prisoner. The Roman general Titus used Josephus, tried to get him to convince the people of Jerusalem to lay down their arms. His account is just heartbreaking. I couldn't recommend any of you to go read it. Because the city was circumvallated, guess what happened? After a time, they began to starve. They began running out of food. Then guess what happened? Cannibalism. Josephus describes it. A mother who cooked and ate her own child. And Titus, the Roman general, in an effort to demoralize the Jewish people, to get them to surrender, just beyond the circumvallation, on an elevated place all around the city, he crucified thousands. Jewish soldiers, Jewish men, women, and children who tried to escape, he nailed them up to crosses. Crucifixion is not a quick death. A healthy person can live on the cross for several days. So the people of Jerusalem, when they looked out, what did they see? A forest of tortured bodies. Now, why did all this happen? This incredible tragedy. Even to this day, did you know, in the Jewish calendar, there is a day of mourning for Jerusalem. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
When I read the Jewish War by Josephus, I was teaching at a retreat center up around that big lake, St. Mary, to the north of us somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I would teach in the morning, and I had the rest of the day free, and so I took Josephus with me. And I read his account of the destruction of Jerusalem. And after a few days, I was so heartbroken, I picked up the cell phone and I called my rabbi friend, Bernard Barsky. And I said, "Bernie, how do you bear it when you read this?" And he said, "Larry, we don't." He said, "There is on the Jewish calendar every year, there is a day of mourning for this terrible event." Why this tragedy? Jesus explains it in the text like this: "Because you did not recognize the time," the Greek word is kairos, "you did not recognize the time." Now there are two Greek words for time. The ordinary one for each moment going along like the beads on a string is the word what? Chronos. But Jesus uses this one. This word designates a season that has come to ripeness and fullness. It designates an opportunity, an opportune moment, when there is a convergence of events, when there is a chance, a possibility. You didn't recognize the opportunity, but guess what it's an opportunity for? The Greek word for visitation is episkopei. Can you say that with me? Episkope, visitation. Now, if you're a reader of Luke's Gospel, you can't avoid recalling at this moment the earlier occasion when Luke has used this word. Where is it? The infancy narratives. Where the angel appears to whom? Mary. Luke describes it as a visitation. In other words, the kairos, the opportunity, the chance, is provided by God's presence. God is there, providing us with the opportunity to go down the road toward peace. And because the Jewish people of Jesus' day did not recognize God's favorable presence, the opportunity for peace, the great tragedy came upon them. They didn't see it. Chapter 19, verses 45 to 46. "And having entered into the temple, he began to drive out the sellers, saying to them, 'It is written, my house will be what? A house of prayer. But you have made it into what? A den of robbers or thieves.'" Now, Luke's account of the action that Jesus took in the temple is very concise. There's a much longer and more detailed account in the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, and it focuses upon the emotions of Jesus at that moment. John says that when he went into the temple, he saw what? Cows and sheep and doves being sold in the courtyard of the temple. And he saw money changers sitting at the table. changing money. And according to John, what did Jesus do? He stooped down and caught up what? Some cords, some straps from the ground. They had probably been used to lead the animals in there. And he whipped them, he knotted them together into what? A whip. And he drove out the animal sellers and the money changers. And the Gospel of John at that point says that when they saw this, the disciples remembered the scripture, "Zeal for your house has consumed me." Now the Greek word for zeal here is the word zelos. And it means a hot burning feeling. It's a description of the moment when emotion ignites, catches flame. So, in an excess of zeal, Jesus drives out the money sellers. People in my business, historians of early Christianity, they don't come to a consensus on very much. That's why there are so many bad reviews out there, even of things that I write. But there is a consensus among scholars that the action that Jesus took in the temple is historical. We can be certain of this. Why? Because any sort of attack on an ancient temple was viewed with horror. And there's no way that it would have been in the interest of the early Christians to fabricate a story about Jesus going into a temple and driving people out. Jesus interprets his own action with the words, again, of a prophecy. My house should be what? A house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers or thieves. Two Old Testament scriptures are conflated here. The first one is Isaiah chapter 56. That's the bit about the house of prayer. The second one is Jeremiah chapter 7. That's the reference to the den of robbers, the spelion, the cave of thieves. So, what Jesus' actions interpreted by the words of Scripture, what they make clear is that Jesus was aiming at reform of the institution of the temple. Jesus' action is directed not at the temple itself, but at those who have corrupted the mission and purpose of the temple for their own profit. Now here I need to tell you a little something about who those people were in the time of Jesus that were making a huge profit out of the temple. The high priest, when Jesus took this action, was a man named, do you know? Caiaphas. He was the son-in-law of a powerful high priest named Annas. This family controlled the high priesthood for an unparalleled. Caiaphas was high priest. This was supposed to be an annual office. He occupied it for 14 years. How do you do that? Complicity with the Romans, with the Roman overlords. And the family of Annas and Caiaphas enriched itself tremendously. First of all, by the ownership of land south of Jerusalem, down toward Bethlehem, where the animals that were provided for sacrifice were raised. They made a profit from that. Secondly, from the money-changing business. When you came to the temple, you would probably have in your pocket or in your hand a coin like this one. Diane got this for me at a museum. It's a Roman coin. It's a denarius, silver. Unfortunately, The chubby boy on this coin is Nero. I'll pass it around for you. They made it in for me into a keychain. You could not bring that into the temple. Why not? What does it have on it? An image. It violates one of the Ten Commandments. So this had to be exchanged for a sacred coin, which was, according to Jewish law, the Tyrian shekel. The Tyrian shekel didn't have a human image on it, and it could be used, first of all, to pay the temple tax. When you came as a Passover pilgrim, you had to pay an entrance fee, the temple tax, and then, of course, to pay for the animals that were purchased for sacrifice. Now, here's what you might not know. In the year 30, so just a couple of years before Jesus came to Jerusalem, a dispute, a political dispute, now we don't know anything about that, do we?
No.
A political dispute broke out between Caiaphas, the highest ranking official in the temple state of Jerusalem, and the Jewish Senate, the Sanhedrin, the Council of Elders. They got to fighting with each other. And Caiaphas, who had the power, his way of fighting with the Senate was that he denied the Sanhedrin the right to hold their meetings within the temple precincts. There was a market owner, a large owner of an animal market. The market was on the side of the Mount of Olives. His name was Bene Haran. And he offered the Sanhedrin a place to meet, since they could no longer meet in the temple precincts. Caiaphas retaliated. Can you guess what he did? He retaliated by opening the outer court of the temple itself, the court of the Gentiles. For what? The sale of animals. That was his way of striking back at Bene Haran and the Jewish Senate. So that's what those animal sellers are doing there, inside the temple itself. Something that had not happened before until the year 30. That's when animals began to be sold. Now, you may recall at this point, but this is not Jesus' first visit to the temple, is it? No. According to the Gospel of Luke, he had been there once before. When he was what? 12 years old. And what happened to him when he was there? What happened was an epiphany. An epiphany of his own purpose and identity. Somehow he came to understand there who he was and what he had to do. You remember when his parents can't find him, they come back and they find Jesus in the temple debating with the experts in the law, and Mary says, "Didn't you know how worried we would be?" And how does Jesus respond? "I have to be about my Father's business." And he's not talking about who?
Joseph.
Okay, can you put yourself emotionally in the place of Jesus? The last time he was there in the temple, the only time before this, according to the Gospels, he had experienced an awakening of God as his Father, of God's kingdom as his mission and purpose, an awakening. At the age of 12, it took place there in the temple. And now he comes back, and what does he find? This holy place that should be a house of prayer, that for him was a place of awakening. It has now been transformed into what? A den of thieves. It's being exploited for the profit. The prophet of the high priest and his family. Now, at this point, in order to try to bring us closer to the emotions that Jesus might have felt, I have to confess a little bit about my own experience in visiting our Jerusalem. So, when I was a boy, my parents took me to Washington, D.C. And I hope you won't think I was totally naive. I was inspired by what I saw there, especially the Jefferson Memorial. The words there on the wall, "We hold these truths to be what?"
Self-evident.
Self-evident. That all men, today Jefferson would have said people, are created what?
Equal.
And are endowed by their Creator with what? Certain inalienable rights. And among these are what?
Life,
liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I remember standing there as a boy, weeping at the beauty and the inspiration of that place. I went back there next with the Miami Valley School as a parent on the fifth grade bus trip. I went twice with Locke and with Mark. And again, I have to tell you, I found it inspiring. The last time, though, that I was in Washington, D.C., a few years ago, I was invited to place the doctoral hood upon one of my students who celebrated his graduation. He was a pastor. He celebrated his graduation in his church. And I conferred the degree upon him and put the hood on him. His church was located in a suburb south of Washington in what's called Loudoun County. And when I was there, I remarked to my student about the incredible prosperity and opulence of this suburb. And I said, "What's going on here? There's no manufacture." And he told me what? Lobbyists and lawyers. Well, when I got back to Dayton in 2016, I went on the internet and I checked. Did you know that there is a data bank, there's a source online that gives county by county the median household income? The six counties in the United States with the highest median household income. Guess how many of them are Washington, D.C. suburbs? Four. Four of the six. Did you see the story in the news this week? One of the attorneys involved in the impeachment trial, Jay Sekulow, recently received $65 million from, you ready for this? A nonprofit organization. the American Center for Law and Justice, that's what it's called. Of course, it's a shill, right, for a political operation. $65 million from a nonprofit organization. Den of thieves. Well, in conclusion, I want you to notice how the story ends. How the temple episode ends. Because there is good news there for us, believe it or not. It says in Luke chapter 19, verses 47 to 48, "And he was teaching in the temple daily. But the chief priest and legal experts," that is the leaders of the people, "were seeking how to destroy him. And they did not know what to do. For all the people," the Greek word, the ordinary people, "they hung on his words. And they were all ears." It's the way I would translate it. Well, here's the good news for us. Jesus did not panic in the midst of this den of thieves, even though he knows where it's going. He didn't panic. He didn't flee.
He didn't run away back to Galilee. What did he do? He sat down in the middle of the den of thieves and did what? Taught. He was teaching daily in the temple. Boy, that's the message for me. Don't give up. Keep teaching. Keep teaching. And now the second source of hope. Why was there a period when the leaders, the chief priests and the legal experts, why weren't they able to immediately apprehend him and do away with him? Why did he get to teach for a period of a week at least? Why?
Popular support.
Exactly. The vox populi. Right? The voice of the people. They couldn't grab him and do with him what they wanted. Because the people did what? They hung on his every word. And they were all ears. Right? So there's no reason for us to panic or to flee. We just need to teach and to listen to the voice of the people. Okay, we've been through a lot already this morning, and you've learned a whole bunch of new Greek words, right? And I hope that I've succeeded in inviting us into the emotions with which Jesus was struggling. When I ask you especially to put yourself in the position of Jesus, who went into the temple at the age of 12 and had an awakening, and when he goes back there the next time, he finds that the holy place is in the hands of people who are profiting from God's business. All right, questions, comments? Yes, please.
How would our Jewish friends today react to what you're telling us? I mean, they saw Zechariah. They saw all these things.
Thank you.
So their Jesus hasn't come yet.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll tell you the first answer that was given to me by one of the most famous scholars of Judaism at the moment. There's a professor at the University of Chicago, recently retired, named Jonathan Z. Smith. I asked him one day, when I walked by his house, I asked him, he was working in the garden, I said, what does the Z stand for? He said, nothing. I said, my parents didn't give me a middle name, so I just stuck Z in there. Well, you can go online and Google him. He is a strange looking guy. Looks like somebody from the Lord of the Rings movie. And he's one of the greatest living scholars of Judaism. One of his most famous statements. A few years ago, he published a book in which he said, listen to this, if the Romans had not destroyed the temple in the year 70, we Jews would have done it ourselves.
Wow.
What's he talking about? The internal conflicts. The conflict between the ruling, within the ruling class of Judea, between leading families that were competing for control of this money-making machine that the temple had become. It was that conflict that led to the war with Rome. There's a really enlightening book by a Jewish scholar, the director of the Oxford University Center of Jewish Studies, named Martin Goodman. You might want to read this book. It's very readable. Martin Goodman. And the title of the book is The Ruling Class of Judea, and the subtitle is The Origins of the Jewish War Against Rome. And he demonstrates in painstaking detail the origin of the Jewish War Against Rome, the ruling class of Judea. And he demonstrates, this is a Jewish author, demonstrates in painstaking detail that the war that finally led to the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple was precipitated by conflict within the Jewish ruling class itself. So that's what Jewish scholars are telling us, right? That's how they, in fact, are echoing the criticisms of that were made by Jesus 2,000 years ago. Such a good question. Thank you for asking it. More questions, comments? Yes?
Was there any significance to the word in the way he used master?
Thank you, Russell. Did you hear that?
No.
Is there any significance to the word master that Jesus uses when he tells the disciples, say that the master, actually its master, the master of the donkey, has need of it? Now, the Greek word is kurios. Can you say that with me?
Kurios.
And the ordinary meaning is master, the master of a house, right? But this word also means what? Lord. In church, when we say Kyrie eleison, we're saying what? Lord have
mercy.
Now, Luke has built a very interesting word play into the text. When the disciples come in to the village and begin to untie the little donkey, the owners, plural, of the donkey, so the family, probably, to whom the donkey belongs, or maybe the donkey was owned by more than one person, they protest to the disciples. They say, why are you untying the donkey? Now, guess what Luke does? When he says the owners of the donkey, he actually uses the plural of this word. Kurioi. Do you see what he's doing? He's setting up in the minds of the readers a question. To whom does the donkey belong? Who needs to have the use of it? Does it belong to the people who have a deed of ownership? Or does it belong to whom? The kurios, this poor Galilean rabbi who tells the disciples to say, its master has need of it, right? So Luke is pushing upon us a question. Who has the right of use? On what basis and to what purpose should things be used? He's leading us to ask that question. Thank you so much for asking that. I forgot to point it out. It's just one of those things you see only if you're reading the text in Greek. There's no way to capture it in English. Other questions, comments? All right. I know that everybody is eager to go to the Super Bowl. You would have to have a lot of these to get a ticket in Miami. What did I hear on the news this morning? The cheapest seat is $6,000. Yeah, and that's way up at the top. But you and I can sit in front of the TV and watch it for free.
And see a lot more.
Thank you all so much for this hard work today and the insightful points that you've made and questions. Next week, if you want to read ahead, we're going to the Last Supper. To the Last Supper. And to what Jesus did and said there. And once again, I'll be inviting you to get inside Jesus' soul. To try to feel the emotions that he felt. And I hope we can go deeper into how the meal that he gave us is a form of therapy. That's what we'll talk about next week. Thank you.
Thank you.